What's up, everybody? You are listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus, your guide to the world of cinema here in Chicago and all around the world. I am your host, Tom Hush, joined today with my other host, my best friend in the whole world. Don't even at me. It's Connor Cornelius.
Hey, Tom. Love you, Tom. Thank you. Co-host, No Coast Cinema.
No Coast co-host. You are the No Coast co-host.
And my name is Connor Cornelius.
I like the alliteration. Did you do that on purpose?
I did. I got it changed.
Recently, what was it before?
Incredibly recently.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Well, what was it before?
Yeah.
Root Robrin. So the alliteration is still there. It's just that. Yeah. You know,
I feel like the double C kind of works.
Being named after a subterranean plant, it's not as cool as something that in Latin, of course, translates to lover of dogs.
What more can you say about it? But that's my fantastic co-host. Today we are joined with two great guests, two fantastic guests, is Nate Waters and Kara Brooks. They are the co-founders of Into the Void Films, and they are also freelance filmmakers in their own right. How's it going? Thank you so much for joining us.
It's going well. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank
great
you.
Great to be here.
Is this your first time on a podcast?
This is technically my second.
Really? What was the first podcast you were on?
It was, how many years ago?
About four years ago.
4 years. Yeah, probably 4 years ago. I was featured on a podcast about a feature film that I was doing that to this day hasn't been finished yet. I kind of that project, but I was on a short podcast for that.
Fantastic.
Yeah, called the Graveyard Podcast.
Ooh.
Yep.
We actually shot it in a graveyard.
So really?
We did.
Like, well, at least they are, you know, true to name and true to form. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Well, welcome to No Coast Cinema. We really appreciate it. This is our second ever episode. You're really here at the ground level its infancy. We're going to be talking to them a little bit later about their work with Into the Void Films and a little bit about how they got into filmmaking, you know, what they love about the movies the most. But first, we're going to start out with our opening segment, Coming Attractions. So with Coming Attractions, we like to look at the news that is shaping the business of cinema here in the States and around the world because cinema is a global art. Connor, you've got some news about a film that has been a little bit contentious in its release.
Yep. So we got a Deadline article here written by Anthony D'Alessandro, and what it tackles essentially is Ghost in the Shell, or perhaps Ghost in the Shill, in that it is losing horrendous amounts of money, not only domestically, but in the global box office. What anonymous film finance sources have conceded is that Paramount's Ghost in the Shell, the adaptation, which is, of course, an adaptation from a popular manga, stands to lose around $60 million.
$60 million.
Yeah, that's $60 million.
And, you know, it's the opening box office weekend for this. Now, this article was written April 5th. And that's when the film came out. It was opening domestic box office was $18.6 million, which is really not a whole lot, and considering how much they thought this might do.
A lot of critics are criticizing it for relying too heavily on the Chinese and the Japanese markets.
Yeah, and that's something that's really interesting in cinema today, and feel free, Nate and KR, to jump in on this if you feel like it. But we're seeing a lot more movies that are co-produced with Chinese studios that are really relying heavily on the international market to be successful. A specific series that just had its latest installment come out this weekend is The Fast and the Furious. Those have always kind of traditionally done, at least the last few films have traditionally done better than in the international market than here in the States, like really making millions and billion even. The Furious 7 crossed the $1.5 billion mark. It was the third most profitable movie of 2015. Are you guys Fast and the Furious people?
I enjoy those movies.
Are you fam? Are you fam?
I actually do enjoy them. I usually get out to the theater to see them, usually with my brother. My first experience with the first Fast and the Furious, actually, I had come home one day. This is when I was still living with my parents, and my dad went out and bought an entire surround sound speaker system, and I came home and I just hear like cars going all around my living room. So that was like one of my first introductions into the film. I think I had seen it before that, but I don't know. It was just something about them that I don't know. I spoke to me, I guess. I don't know.
For my money, I think the seventh one, directed by James Wan, was probably my favorite. And seeing someone who came from the horror world, like with Saw and Dead Silence, and he came up through the ranks, you know, and have him jump on into this huge studio project, it kind of feels like the inmates are running the asylum. So that's fun. And the same thing with Fate of the Furious. It's directed by the guy that did like Friday and Straight Outta Compton. So to see, like, you know, they get these different directors, and I think they got Justin Lin, who did that Bruce Lee movie. I forget, it came out like 95. It's like Something okay. the Dragon.
Yeah, you know? And Justin Lin has been with the franchise
for a
while.
Long time.
He started with Tokyo Drift.
Yeah. Okay, so who directed? Rob Cohen did the first one then, right?
Yeah, Rob Cohen was the first one, and then they had John Singleton for Too Fast.
And then it was basically
Justin Lin up through number seven, James Wan.
Yeah.
But you guys pointed out the directors here and who's working on these films, it's a lot more diverse. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, going to that larger international market, especially with Justin Lin and James Wan being very popular. They're Asians. They are Asian American, or at least, you know, I don't know if they're Asian American. That's probably misspeaking there, but they're non-white.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're bringing diversity to the role. But
Speaking of which, diversity
is another problem with Ghost in the Shell.
Exactly. Of course. The big controversy, if you've heard anything about it, is the whitewashing controversy, casting Scarlett Johansson as the lead in a story written by a Japanese artist. That's not exactly a problem that you're running. Whitewashing isn't a problem you're running into with the Fast and the Furious franchise.
Yeah. And with the Ghost in the Shell, to bring it back to this, is... You know, if you're going to rely heavily on the international markets, now, granted, Scarlett Johansson is an international star. She's in the Avengers. She's well known, and she's well known for playing roles that do involve some sort of stoic cybernetic thing. Like, she was the voice in Her, and even in Under the Skin, where she was not a robot, she had that kind of stoic thing. So, realistically speaking, it's not a terrible choice for an actress, but how do you guys feel about the race thing in terms of, are they being dishonest or are they just trying to bank on a star?
I think obviously using her as a name actress to get this property off the ground is a big thing. But as far as like casting international actors in movies that are going to cater to international audiences, I feel like that's really important.
Mm-hmm. If you're going to rely on Japan and China.
Get some people from those countries in the movie to represent those countries. You know?
I mean, and that happens in... a lot of Hollywood movies now is that they'll bring in a good example is Star Wars Rogue One. You had two Asian actors playing prominent roles that, you know, maybe people overseas can identify with better than just having the traditional white protagonist. And even, you know, Diego Luna playing a major role in Rogue One probably helped, at least in terms of having people identify with the characters and giving a little bit of diversity. What do you think, Connor?
Well, it is interesting that they decided to do that with Star Wars. However, I will say I don't think those characters were very fleshed out at all. They do maybe seem just to be thrown in there, for lack of a better word.
Is it like tokenism, in a sense?
Maybe not necessarily tokenism, but specifically with, you know, obviously Star Wars, that's going to be a huge thing in world culture for at least the next several decades, right? I mean, it's been huge ever since it came out in the 80s or late 70s.
Yeah, Star Wars was actually celebrating its 40th anniversary. Side note.
40th anniversary.
Star Wars, yeah,
since
1977. 77. Yeah, 77.
Math.
But Ghost in the Shell, right? I mean, it's a niche intellectual property, as the article points out. You're not going to quite get the Fast and the Furious crowds to go see it. You're not going to get the Star Wars fans to go see it necessarily, unless it's great. And
you know, it's one of the things that meant. Yeah, it's the niche IP. It's exactly what you're saying. It's a niche intellectual property. There are fans here, but you know, they're rather few and far between, and they were too turned off by the whole whitewashing scandal to the casting of Scarlett Johansson to really even give it a chance.
And you're seeing the same thing with the Death Note Netflix.
Yeah.
Is it a miniseries or a movie?
I think it's a movie. Okay. And it's
I hope it's a movie.
Yeah.
It's directed by Adam Wingard, who did Blair Witch, and You're Next, and The Guest. And
yeah, a great director. And it has Nat Wolff, who's been in a few films. He's, I think, fairly popular for being in some John Green adaptations, but he's a knowable name. Willem Dafoe is in it.
Awesome.
But like, people are still upset. They're like, why are you taking this Japanese property and not using Asian actors?
And is that not an encouraging sign about sort of the developments that are happening not only in film as an art, but as, you know, the culture that's inherent in that?
Right. I think it is encouraging that people are asking for some diversity. I mean, we'll probably talk about this later, but with Get Out, you know, a massive film, massive in terms of how much money it brought in, it was incredibly successful because it was made by a black director, had a black protagonist tackling some serious issues for the black community, and people really responded to that. They really wanted to see those stories because they're tired of seeing just like, you know, white dudes running around shooting things. Maybe we need something a little bit more salient, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, it seems to be reflecting sort of a change in standards for Hollywood and for film in general. I think the internet seems to have a decent impact on that. I know that the whitewashing controversy was largely spread through that, you know, social media outlets and all of that. But it does seem to be reflecting moviegoer outrage at Hollywood's proclivity towards hiring white actors in situations that doesn't necessarily call for that casting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the studios, they're on social media. They see people's comments. They if they see this kind of backlash against Ghost in the Shell or, you know, Old Boy or Death Note or what have you, they respond to that, and they're not going to make that mistake twice.
Let's hope so. Let's really hope so.
I'm giving them some credit.
Yeah. You know? Because especially if you're going to lose, you know, this is $100 million+ movie. If you're going to lose $60 million on that, someone's getting in trouble, and hopefully
that executive got in trouble that day.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Hopefully they're not going to make that same mistake. Speaking of mistakes, let's go over to the Academy Awards, the kings of making mistakes in movies and movie culture.
Never.
So they have released some changes to the rules for the upcoming, next year's Academy Awards. I wouldn't say upcoming necessarily, but next year's Academy Awards, they've made some changes based on what happened this last year. One of them is dealing with documentaries. You know, the winner for Best Documentary this past Academy Awards was O.J. Made in America, which was originally a multi-part documentary released on television on ESPN. And, you know, it was episodic, but it did get a theatrical release. So therefore, it was eligible, and it beat out some pretty great documentaries that were one contiguous program. Beat 13th, the documentary by Ava DuVernay. It beat out I Am Not Your Negro, which is a fantastic documentary. Not saying that O.J. Made in America wasn't good. Mm-hmm. It was good, but it didn't really meet the – it met a criteria that really shouldn't have been there, I guess. So they're changing it so that multi-part documentaries are no longer eligible to get into that category. It has to be one contiguous thing. Do you guys prefer that? Do you think it's a good idea, or does O.J. Made in America deserve the same chance to win something at the Academy Awards?
I mean, I think it depends on its intended distribution method. Like, there's a part of me that does kind of feel like if it was originally put on TV in mini episodes or in episodes and kind of compartmentalized like that, it should be judged as that because that was the intended form for it. But at the same time, I can kind of see why filmmakers would get upset if they, you know, made something in that form, condensed it into a feature, and then now they're disqualified. It's kind of hard, man. Like, I guess you got to – it's a case-by-case scenario. I think maybe instead of having, like, a overall rule, they should play it, like, by ear.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, when it's released on TV, well, if it's really good, why shouldn't it be – it's a documentary. Why shouldn't it be up for Best Documentary? Because we have the Emmys. You know, maybe there needs to be a category. I don't know if there is a category in the Emmys for TV documentaries. because there's some pretty great stuff out there. Like, you know, ESPN's own 30 for 30 series has been uber successful in its intent, and people really enjoy them. So why don't they deserve to be recognized, but maybe not in the same vein as something that is, you know, so meticulously edited to be a 2-hour documentary meant to be seen at one time, not over many different episodes.
I think there is a certain strength in being able to convey a message in that short amount of time. The OJ documentary, it spanned, you know, 9 or 10 hours.
Yeah.
Right? So there is a certain strength in filmmaking in being able to convey, you know, maybe a, or at least make order out of, you know, the chaos of the real world in under 2.5 hours. Taking 10 hours to do that, to take that case of the OJ trial, maybe it could have, you know, if it had been condensed in a little bit more, it might have actually portrayed that the director was a little bit more of a competent film. Not to say that it's that they're incompetent filmmakers, but
they were trying to make something that would fit that particular style. It's just a question of style, really,
because that's what a documentary really is, right? Is kind of taking a story and trying to construct an order around it, even though what actually happened was much more chaotic.
Right. I would say, for me, it was almost like saying, you know, Band of Brothers, if you took Band of Brothers, released it in a theater, and called it a movie.
Yeah.
Well, that's just totally unfair. That's almost 10 hours of storytelling. Mm-hmm. That's going to beat out Saving Private Ryan every time. You know, mm-hmm. that's just not fair. You get that much time to tell a story.
I get into a similar debate sometimes with other horror fans about whether or not the It TV movie counts as a feature film.
I was just thinking about that.
Because people are like, the new one's a remake. And so my argument is that it's not really a remake. It's just a new version of the book, right? Because they're all adaptations of the book. But yeah, it's a TV movie, and it's longer than a normal movie would be, I think. So I don't really consider it a remake of that version of it, you know? Yeah.
Mr. Brooks, you have any thoughts on that?
For It in particular? I mean, I kind of agree with Nate. Like, if you can, I guess you have to, I'm not sure what I'm trying to say.
I mean, it's an interesting topic. Like, how do you tell someone what their work is or isn't based on the medium it was released in?
Yeah. Right.
If you watch It, the one with Tim Curry, you know, if you watch that one in its entirety, is it not just a really long movie? Because when you're watching it at home, it's not really in two episodes. I don't know. I've never seen the home media release.
It's a two-sided DVD.
Because
it's so long, so you got to flip it over at the halfway point.
So if you watch the Lord of the Rings extended editions where you have to change the disc in the middle of it, like, is it different? I mean, I don't know. It's a good
nut to crack open. There's some good questions in there. And also, too, like the It TV series or TV movie is really interesting because it was very scary as a kid. But you go back and I just watched it a couple weeks ago, and it's not that scary at all. It's pretty bad. You know, like, no offense to Tommy Lee Wallace. Like, I love your movies. I love Halloween 3. But something about that movie just doesn't hold up. But Tim Curry is fucking on fire. He's on fire in that movie.
That movie terrified me when I was younger when I saw it. It did. I was up
two
all
episodes or
night.
No, you know.
Yeah, I was up all night, and I couldn't go to sleep because I thought he was in the room with me.
Oh, jeez.
Like in the shower, you think he's going to come out of the drain? And,
in your dreams.
I watched It. I didn't actually know that it was a two-part, double-sided DVD situation when I started it. And like you said, it's not. I don't think that it's a great movie, but there was some part of my life that there just some part of me that was terrified of storm drains, and then I saw that scene where It is trying to convince the child to come down, and I was like, oh, that's it. That's where that scared me comes from.
And maybe the two-parter, I mean, we're talking about adapting a massive book.
Yeah.
Something to the effect of like 1,100
pages. 1,100
pages. And so maybe
that
was
the abridged version.
Yeah, that's maybe that's the only way to present it was in the two episodes on TV.
That's, Stephen King has a version of The Stand that's like 1,300 pages.
Oh, yeah.
That's the director's cut.
Yeah, unrated version of The Stand.
Yeah.
So who knows? We'll have to see at the next Academy Awards how that goes. But another rule change that they have, and this pertains to animation, is that now, starting with this next Academy Awards, any member of the Academy is allowed to be on the nomination process for Best Animated Feature Film. Now, that's a change from its original ruling, which was you basically had to work in the animation field for a certain amount of time. You had to be part of so many productions, and then you were part of the nomination process. This is opening it up to everybody, and there's a little bit of worry about who's going to get pushed out in terms of nominations. Now, this past year, there was a good mix. You're always going to get the Disneys. You're going to get the Zootopia. You're going to get your Moana. But this past year, we saw films like The Red Turtle. We saw My Life as a Zucchini. A lot of smaller productions that not a lot of people are going to see, much less children. Really, I don't know if any of you have seen The Red Turtle or My Life as a Zucchini.
No.
But they're not really kid-focused. Like, you know, this isn't going to see Moana. This is a little bit more intense. My Life as a Zucchini deals with, like, orphans and, like, abandonment and all this kind of stuff. And The Red Turtle is ostensibly, like, a silent film. There's no dialogue. It's all just regular sound and animation. So when you're opening it up to more people, would you guys be afraid that they're going to just push out those art film, those more arty films in order to get animation that's more popular?
I don't think that Pixar is going to have any competition getting that nomination. They're always going to be in there.
Yeah, they're always going to be in there. But are we just going to see more stuff that's, you know, a little bit more commercial? The ones that people have actually seen. Because, you know, you may be a member of the Academy, you may work in Hollywood, that doesn't mean you see every movie that comes out.
Yeah.
And there's already a problem in the sense that a lot of films get nominated just because, like, I kind of wanted to see it and it looked good, like, click, you know, check that one off. In my opinion, there's been a lot of mistakes over the years. Are we going to open this up to more mistakes just by not having people who understand what they're talking about?
I think it's kind of tricky because they had that system in place to kind of weed out people who were a little too new to the system, you know? So it's interesting. I hope that's not what happens because, like, some of the best shorts that you see are the independent stuff, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Independent. I mean, if you look at Spirited Away, that was Best Animated Feature in, 2002. Fun fact, the first film to win Best Animated Feature, does anybody know? Oof. Yeah, that category was instituted in 2001, so the very first winner was Shrek.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
Nice.
I just had to say that.
Okay.
But Spirited Away.
Greatest of all time.
Yeah. Spirited Away, in my opinion, one of the greatest animated films of all time.
Talking about Shrek.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Let's forget about Spirited Away. Let's talk about Shrek and Donkey.
Let's get down to the real issues here. Do you have the whole story? The 4-piece box set?
My son loves Shrek. So we've seen the first and second one like a million times, right? And right now he's on a Moana kick. So we watch Moana on loop at my house.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, when you guys said Moana, I just had like PTSD flashes of like, consider the coconut the what?
Oh my gosh. But
Tom.
with Studio Ghibli, and specifically Spirited Away, those are pretty obscure films at the time, and then Spirited Away really cracks it open because it gets distributed in the U.S. by Disney. So that had the help of its corporate backing, but could a film like Spirited Away without that backing really do that again? I'm thinking specifically about this movie that came out in the States recently called Your Name, and it's like the biggest selling film in Japan of 2016. Like, I think it beat the all-time record, which was set was by Spirited Away. It's made millions upon millions and millions of dollars, and just got released in the U.S. I don't know if it's going to be eligible, but could it get picked even if nobody's really seeing it in the Academy? They're going to ignore that. I'm just going to say that right now. They're going to ignore a film like that. And
especially if they don't do an English translation.
Luckily, they did. They did a dub.
Oh, okay.
And I actually saw the dub. It's a very good movie. And I think if it should be eligible for at least best foreign language or something like that, or foreign animated. But with these rule changes, I don't know. We could see a degrading of the. I feel like I'm really.
Well, could
in
it
this
not,
animation thing? I'm
yeah,
like,
yeah. Well,
the animation.
Well, it's an interesting question because
danger.
I mean, for a lot of people, the Oscars are the pinnacle of cinema, especially if you're dealing with big money, which obviously all films require. But I mean, the Oscars are, yeah, like I said, the pinnacle of artistic achievement in cinema for a lot of people.
Yeah.
That change kind of begs the question, will taking the control of this nomination process away from the people who actually worked in the animation industry, is that going to dilute the nomination process where people are just sort of following the popular opinion about what should be nominated? Or is it going to, because I know that they did recently hire, the Academy tried to get a little bit more of a diverse population.
Right. They instituted some rules about how long you could be in the Academy based on, like, how frequently you're voting, how long it's been since your last, like, piece of work in the industry.
So the question is, giving those people, everyone in the Academy, the same amount of power for that nomination process, is that going to dilute it, or is it going to maybe open it up a little bit more even?
Yeah, that's actually, you know what, I did not consider that. You could really get some more diverse voices. To put it to you guys, I know, Nate, you're a big fan of horror. Mr. Brooks, you're also a horror guy?
Yes.
All right. Well, Into the Void films. I know you guys have had some horror. When you guys look for opinion on horror, do you look only to people who work inside the industry, or do you, you know, how would you feel if someone that really doesn't know a whole lot of horror starts naming best horror films of, you know, the year?
So as a horror fan, a lot of the stuff that we do doesn't really make it to the Academy Awards, but when it does, it's awesome. Like when The Exorcist, I think, got like 5 or 6 nominations,
and that was the first horror film to ever be nominated. Mm-hmm.
But it was made by like a very competent director.
Oh yeah,
so like you can't deny like horror outside of that movie. Like it's just a very well made movie, and it plays really well as a drama too.
Right.
But also seeing like Silence of the Lambs, you know, like every once in a while there's a horror movie that'll go to the Oscars. So I'm kind of used to liking movies that are kind of considered garbage by most people.
Yeah.
So to me, like I enjoy the Oscars. I have fun watching them, but I really kind of take them with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we come from a genre where people, you know, we're like the redhead stepchild of the industry. So, I mean, it's totally okay for me, you know, and I'm fine being designated to that part of town, I guess.
But even within taking the Oscars out of it, within just looking at movies, would you rather listen to people who you feel know the genre a lot better, are more involved with the genre, even to the point of working within that genre? Or do you, you know, you don't mind opening it up to people who aren't necessarily as versed in that style as you guys and get those opinions there?
I mean, everyone's entitled to their own opinion on whatever they may view or and consume as a viewer, but I personally, like, as far as reviews go or opinions on other people, I honestly don't care. I have to see it for myself.
Yeah. Right.
Because my style, my taste is going to be different than, I mean, well, Nate's the only exception. We, like, have the same brain, I think.
We share our brain.
For some,
the hive mind.
I was wondering what that was.
But honestly, you know, my fiance will look up reviews on every single movie before we see them, and I'm like, I don't care.
Wow.
I don't care. I want to see it, and I don't want to know anything about it, really. I mean, you know, besides, like, the teasers or the trailers that I watch. But honestly, you know, I have to view it for myself, and I'll talk to anyone about, you know, oh, you liked X horror movie or whatever it may be, and that's fine, you know, because there's have been many times where other horror filmmakers have told me, you have to see this movie, it's amazing, and I'll hate it. So
yeah, you gotta take it all with a little, as you said, Nate, a grain of salt.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's times where people that are huge horror fans will tell you that a movie that you know will probably be great sucks.
Yeah.
Like, I had someone, you know, at the Music Box be like, don't see Raw, it sucks.
And Raw was incredible.
Yeah, I've been hearing nothing but excellent things about that movie. So, you know, like, yeah, everybody has their own opinion. Everybody's going to be different. And, like, for me, one of my favorite movies is a slasher movie. It's a Jolly. It's called Pieces. Have you guys ever heard of it?
No,
I haven't.
So it's basically a killer on this college campus, and he's going around killing college girls, and he's taking, like, so if a girl's a ballerina dancer, he takes her legs. If he kills a swimmer, he takes her arms. And he's putting, he's, like, making this Frankenstein girl. And then it cuts to, like, weird flashbacks of him as a child putting together this jigsaw puzzle of, like, a naked woman, and, like, his mom comes in, is like, what are you doing, and beats him up. So I guess that cracked him, right?
Yeah.
But that movie's like, it's pretty awful, but it's known within, like, you know, by horror fans as being this kind of like this cult classic, right?
Okay, yeah.
I love that movie, but if I brought that up around people in film school, they'd think it was insane.
It's disgusting.
What do you mean? Ugh.
I hear you. So, really, I guess it's just going to be, let's see what happens here, but, you know, take all opinions, including those of the Academy, take them with a little grain of salt. You know, try to get out there and see it. I think people who are listening to this podcast share that philosophy with you guys. Mm-hmm. All right. So we're going to take a little break here. But when we come back, we're going to move into our feature presentation. We're going to be talking Into the Void films. We're going to be talking about some influences, talking about where you guys, you know, came up in the industry, all that good stuff coming up next on No Coast Cinema. Hey everybody, you are back here with No Coast Cinema on WGN Plus. I am your host, Tom Hush, joined as always by my best friend and worst enemy, my arch enemy, who I made my friend, Connor Cornelius.
Tom, I love you and I hate you as I love and hate myself, and yeah. I'm so glad to be here and with these two wonderful guests.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We got Nate Waters and K.R. Brooks from Into the Void Films. They are the co-founders of Into the Void and freelance filmmakers in their own right. They've been with us so far this whole episode, and we really appreciate it. Guys, how are you finding Tribune Tower so far?
It's great. Yeah, thank you for having us.
Awesome.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So glad you could be with us.
You guys really should say the No Coast host with the most.
The No Coast host. Okay.
Well, we're working on it.
Okay, sorry.
Okay.
It's under development.
Let me put that into my phone.
Don't give the people too much of a glimpse behind the curtain.
Yeah, I don't want them to enjoy this too much.
Okay.
I don't want them to.
Because once we do that, what do we do that from there?
Yeah, where do we
Fair
go?
Enough.
they are, co-founders of Into the Void Films. Why don't you guys tell us a little bit about Into the Void? When did you guys get started? What was the initial vision of this this company?
So I think it was founded after Nate and I did our first film, but I don't like to tell that story. I like to go back to the first time I actually met Nate, and that was on another film that we both had. I was the cinematographer. He was the
assistant director.
And the first time I met him, it was at a conference room at Columbia College. And I'm going to let Nate tell the story because he tells it way better than I do.
Okay. So, yeah, we met at a production meeting for a short film called Critical Mass, not to be confused with Critical Ass. But, yeah, sorry.
Which everybody, of course, has seen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the one people did watch, not ours. But so it was a short film, and we met at this production meeting, and they were doing one of those kind of like get to know each other exercises where it was like go around the room, say your name, what you do on the crew, and then what your favorite movie is. And it got to me, and I was sitting right across from Kevin. And Kevin, if you know, no one's ever seen him before, he's a pretty tall dude.
You said 6'9"?
Yes.
Yes.
He's got a lot of tattoos, you know, he's sitting there with his arms crossed. He looks pretty not confrontational, but you know, I don't want to mess with this guy. So it got to me and I said, "Hi, I'm Nate and my favorite movie is The Shining. I'm a big horror movie fan. I wear that shit on my sleeve and I just get it right out there." And Kevin just his arms crossed, he looks dead serious and he just nods. And so then at that point I was like, "He's my friend." And like we didn't really talk, but like I think that's really like a testament to people, like horror fans are the most passionate people that I know. Like we're like, "Oh, you like The Shining? I like The Shining. We're friends."
Yeah.
You know, and from then on, like when we were on set, we would just talk about stuff we liked. We're like, "Oh, you like Pan's Labyrinth? Okay, like it's one of my favorite movies. Or you like Let Me In or Let the Right One In?" Or,
yeah.
So and from there on, you know, we just we had an idea for a short film, which was called Void. And that's where we got the name Into the Void Films. And we've just been doing short films and working on other stuff ever since then.
So you both went to Columbia College, is that correct?
Yes.
Correct. And what were your specific concentrations?
You know, when I started at Columbia, it was editing at first. But as I started to go through the classes and whatnot, because they kind of give you an overall understanding of everything. You know, you write your own film, you produce it. So you get to do all these facets in filmmaking. And mine, I really loved editing, which I still do today, but I eventually got into actually shooting film, so cinematography. So that's primarily what I do now for Into the Void, along with some editing and a little bit of writing. Not so much anymore.
And yourself, Nate, are you taking the writing reins?
For the most part, but it's a big collaboration. Like everything that we do, it's like being in a band. Everybody in the band has to sign off on it.
Right.
So I won't really take any specific direction until Kevin signs off on it, just because, like he said, we have such similarly aligned interests that like we never are on different pages.
Yeah. And did you study? What did you study specifically at Columbia?
I have a BA and BS. That's what a lot of people say. I'm just kidding. So I started studying directing, and I quickly learned, like, after a year or two of doing that, you know, you didn't really get to do as much of, like, the writing and producing stuff. So I changed my major to a general major, and I could take, like, screenwriting classes. That's when I took my first assistant directing class, which has, you know, been really useful because that's what I do a lot as a freelance artist. But, yeah, I switched majors.
All right, cool. Nate, I know you and I have talked. You're from Rock Falls, yep. Illinois.
Rock Falls, Illinois.
And
that'll be another horror movie that we'll work on eventually.
Children of the Corn.
And KR, you are, you said Portage Park?
Portage Park area, yeah. Chicago, Illinois, my entire life.
So growing up in Chicago, did you watch a lot of movies growing up? I know there you got a theater out there in Portage Park.
I do, yeah. We have the Patio Theater, which is about two blocks away from my parents' house. So I grew up right next to a small, like, boutique theater, I guess you can call it. So I would always go there. My main introduction into film and movies and whatnot was actually just the little rental house that was a block away, you know, right across the street from the park. And I would go there every weekend with my dad or mom. And I would actually specifically go straight to the horror section and look at all the creepy covers. And then I'd pick one out when I was old enough for them to say, okay, you can finally watch this film now. So that's how I got my introduction to everything, really.
So did the horror draw you just because of the cool covers, or did you already have an interest in the horrific and the macabre?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of both, to be honest. Yeah, I always... what was the one? Peter Jackson's horror film.
Dead Alive.
Dead Alive. Yeah, that was one of them. That it was just great.
Party's over.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I just always had this... interest in horror and dark films, so that's just how it started, really.
And Nate, growing up in Rock Falls, what was your access to the world of cinema like? Same deal, your local theater, your rent, you know, your movie rental place?
Yeah, very similar to Kevin's experience, except there was a drive-in in my hometown, and they would like Dust Till Dawn 35 millimeter prints of, like, you know, awesome lineups like Nightmare on Elm Street, Robert Englund's Phantom of the Opera, and then, like, Night of the Comet, and it's just, like, a lot of weird stuff, you know?
And what was it like sitting in the drive-in watching, like, how do you feel that affected
it's
you?
It's amazing. It's a really nostalgic experience, and even though I didn't grow up in the 70s, I can really appreciate, in an age where everything's digital, having someone string up, you know, like, because they it's like the Grindhouse, right, where they would show, like, vintage trailers in between the movies,
right?
So it's just like a night out at the movies, and I would often sneak in through the trunk of my friend's car, so it's like the whole, that kind of, like, cliche experience of just being a teenager and growing up in a small town, you know.
Wow.
But I also, same thing, I would watch movies from the mom and pop video store, and, you know, my twin brother and I would, like, scour the horror section and just, like, find the weirdest stuff we could. And, yeah, just kind of stem from there.
And those kinds of experiences are getting rarer and rarer as
right.
time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to be able to produce filmmakers with that sort of, you know, interest in the lesser known films and horror going forward, or it's at least going to be a little bit more difficult.
It'll be kids coming up like, oh, I streamed all those movies back.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, oh yeah, I had to find, like, you know, a weird VHS at the bottom of someone's box in a garage sale, you know. And that's, I mean, like, that's how it kind of was for me. It was just like a word of mouth thing, like, oh, I found this movie called Luther the Geek, have you heard about it? And yeah, that's the fun of it.
Do you feel that that's the guiding spirit behind Into the Void films? Is that the kind of films you want to make in terms of things that people find and really enjoy on a level that's not necessarily, you know, oh, this is a critically acclaimed sort of thing? It could be critically acclaimed, but from the way you're describing it, it's this idea of film where it's not about whether it's bad or good. It's whether you enjoy it and yeah. you have the experience. Do you feel like that's Into the Void for you guys?
I hope so. I mean, like, obviously at this point we haven't really broken through into that much of like a mainstream audience or anything. I think we are our niche, you know. I think our most viewed video is like maybe like 1,000 or maybe a couple more views than that. But like, we've had people say like really nice things to us, like, oh, we've watched your movies and we like them, and like, they're people we don't know. And to me, that's already a really nice feeling to have people that you don't know saying, oh, I got that reference you made, or like, I appreciate where you went with this one, you know.
Now tell us a little bit about making your first feature, so The Void, or Void. Rather, because yeah. we don't want to confuse it with
The Void.
There's a lot of films with Void in
the
titles.
Enter the Void as well. Yeah,
exactly. So working on Void, tell us what that was like, you know, deciding to make this project.
Nate and I, through talking on set with the first film that we ever did, started to talk to him about fairy tales and in specific dark fairy tales, which one of my favorite films is Pan's Labyrinth. So, and that's exactly what that film is essentially. So I said, what if we did something like that? And we got to talking, and it eventually turned into a musical dark fantasy horror film.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Which for two guys who just finished film school was just an almost impossible task.
Very ambitious.
Very ambitious indeed.
It's like Sweeney Todd, not set on Earth.
Totally. And we like did demos and stuff. We had like six songs ready.
Yeah,
like,
we had songs ready to go. And then we got to a point where we're like, you know what? We might not have the money to do this or to do it right, the way we would want to. Mm-hmm. So we actually scrapped the musical idea, but kept the story.
Okay.
And we ended up doing that.
Well, at least that still exists. And so raising the money, that's an important thing. And we actually, if you listen to our last episode with Jake Wiseman of Capper Movie House, that was something we talked about, is this idea of raising the money. How did you guys get about raising the money? Did you do Kickstarter, Indiegogo, or were you just kind of scrimping and saving yourself?
I want to say, and I don't know, Nate can back me up on this, I think Void, we raised the most money for Void out of any film that we've done in the past 4 years.
Do you remember how much that was, roughly?
About $1,700, I think. $1,500, $1,700.
Yeah. Wow.
And then also we put in about like 15 to 2 of our own money into it. So like all together it was about $4,000.
So that $1,700, that came from just independent donations?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then we would like, so people would get perks. So like we sent people scripts or like DVDs of the movie once it was all finished up. And
yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of like diminishing returns because we've done it since then and we've had like moderate success, but that first one was the one that we actually were able to get like, you know, some dough for.
Well, right. It's yeah. because those, I would say 99% of those donations were family and friends.
Yeah.
You know, just people who knew we make films and were excited to support us, whether it be $5, whether it be $100. There were just a lot of people who came out and said, okay, you know what, here's some money, go do what you do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're very grateful for those people who came out and did that for mm-hmm. us.
With the family portion of it, have your families been pretty supportive of your aspirations?
Yeah. For sure. I mean, my mom and dad showed me a lot of these horror movies that I'm obsessed with now. And, you know, my dad was the one taking me to the video store. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think like it was a natural progression for me to want to be a filmmaker. And that's all I've ever really wanted to do since I was a little kid. And I saw the first Halloween, I wanted to be a director. So they've, you know, been very supportive of that.
How about yourself, Kara?
Yeah, it's the same thing with me. To this day, every time I visit my parents or someone in my family, they always ask me, "Hey, what do you got going on? Do you have anything that you know you can show me?" Like, and I try and have at least something to show them because they're just so like vested into the idea that it's just really cool. Well, actually, my favorite thing is when I show people some of our work. They always say, this looks like a real movie.
Yes.
Well, good.
Good. That's what we wanted. Yeah.
That's what I was going for. Yes. So
you're not going for fake movies.
Yeah, right. Or like they're shot on like a handy cam or something. Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like a film that could potentially be in theaters, I guess. So that's always nice to hear from people. But I always try, and they're very supportive of it.
Well, that's important, obviously. Emotional and financial support, always a good thing. But something we did talk about on the previous episode with Jake Wiseman from Capra Movie House is the matter of distribution. What did you guys decide to do in order to get Void out to build your audience?
Well, I think our first thought was to do a couple screenings around Chicago. And then, we basically just put it up online. With that one, we weren't really thinking about like a long-term distribution plan. We were just so excited to get it out. We did a couple of screenings and we just put it right up. But after that, we really started building up content. We wanted to make as many shorts as we could. And with shorts, the only real way of distribution is kind of film festivals or putting it up yourself, but with some of our later shorts, we were able to take them to some festivals. Our latest one, Writer's Block, played at the Chicago Horror Film Festival last year, and that was really cool. But as far as distribution, besides festivals, we just put our stuff right up on our YouTube page.
Which that one played at the Patio Theater.
Yeah, at the Patio.
Where I grew, two blocks away.
So it's like full circle for Kevin.
Sounds like a surreal experience.
It was. Yeah, it was really cool to have it up there. Although, personally, it's hard for me to watch my own stuff, especially with other people. I don't know why. I feel like there's a lot of filmmakers or actors or anyone in that field who feels that same way. But it was a really cool experience.
Nate, we've talked off mic before about seeing your own films screened in front of people and audience. Can you speak a little bit about audience reaction and how you deal with that?
Sure. So In Hiding is a feature script that I wrote last year, and it's kind of like taking the best elements from like Evil Dead and Reservoir Dogs. So it's basically a couple characters stuck in a warehouse and there's a demon in the basement and we see what happens, So we did a short film that was like a 5-minute proof of concept for that idea. And Tom and I both work at the New 400 Theater. Stop there. It's
Roger
Sheridan.
Yeah.
Plug. But every Halloween, they do the Scare Fest, which is a 1-week long marathon of different horror movies. And everybody knows that I'm a horror nut. So they asked me if I wanted to curate the thing as well as play some of our stuff. So we played a bunch of our other shorts as well as this proof of concept short for In Hiding. And the last night of the Scare Fest, they had The Exorcist playing. It was this beautiful 4K restoration, and it looked like $1 million. But we played before that, and that was the only night of this fest that they sold out. So it was like 150 people in this tiny theater, just wall to wall people. And it was my first time, and probably Kevin's as well. Watching any of our stuff in front of a real audience. And there's a lot of people that really dug it, and there's a lot of people who were like cheering us on and clapping and really feeling it. And then there are some people who are heckling us a little bit. Which, it could be a little rough when the filmmakers are in the house. One of our friends who's one of the actors, kind of told those people to shut up. But for me, honestly, it never bothered me. I think I'm so used to this being a kind of a genre that people don't appreciate it, that I'm not expecting everybody to get what we do, and I'm not really looking for approval. But it was a skin thickening experience to have someone right in front of you be like,
"That's
your movie."
Totally throwing it at you.
My favorite moment about screening that, because we had some of the crew and some of the actors and actresses come out, and the best part was one of the leads in Hiding sat down in a seat in the theater, and a guy across the aisle from her, I don't know him, he was a random guy, he looks at her, he's like, "Do I know you?" And she's like, "Well, I'm in a couple of the shorts that have been playing throughout the last week." So he had been to the theater throughout the week and noticed her, and he was like starstruck. He was like, "Oh my God, you're the actress in these films that I've been watching." And it was just the coolest experience thing to see. It was great. It was just really cool.
What do you guys got coming up the pipeline?
Well, right now we finished a couple of proof of concept shorts for two feature scripts that we want to try to get made. So right now we're basically just trying to take these out and see if we can create some interest. And I'm just writing a lot in addition to freelancing on other people's projects. So I'm about to start up on a feature, and I'm trying to finish up on a sci-fi script before then. So just creating content, man, just trying to make as much stuff as I can.
Very cool. How about yourself, KR?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Nate and I work on, you know, most of the same stuff. You know, and when I'm not actually on set shooting a film, you know, a proof of concept or whatever we have going, I'm usually researching stuff on, because I mainly do a lot of or all of the cinematography. So, you know, it's always a learning process. There's always new things coming out, new, I don't want to say techniques, but just this wealth of information that just you have to kind of stay ahead of. So it's like that. That's what my a lot of my free time is, just on either YouTube or whatever it may be, and
just getting ahead,
reading articles, and on new gear coming up or whatever. So I do a lot of that while he's writing our films.
Yep. He's writing. God,
yeah.
That's actually writers. If I can take a side street for a second, if I was to give any advice to anyone who wants to start up in film, it would be to PA. And to try to be an assistant on every department of a production that you can, because there's a lot of directors who don't know anything about how a film works, and they show up and they want all of these unrealistic things. But if you've worked for production design, if you've helped put a camera together, and you understand all those things, then you're not going to be a surprise when, you know, the day hits you over the head.
Yeah,
that's my big advice, because you see a lot of people that are kind of like in love with the idea of making movies, but they don't want to learn everybody's job.
And you've worked on quite a few sets.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've been consistently on set since I was about 20, you know, so about 5 years or 6 years of doing it. So
you know, what's it like knowing it from the ground up?
It's awesome. I mean, like, it's pretty thankless being the guy that has to sit in the truck and watch the gear all day.
Yeah.
But then, you know, being the AD, you're literally the person keeping the schedule together. You have to send the schedule to everybody. If somebody shows up late, it's your fault.
Wow.
It's everything rolls on you, so you have to be in charge of everybody's department. That would be my biggest advice, is just try to get on other people's sets, even if it's like a music video, if it's a feature, a commercial. Specifically, if you can get on a commercial or get on something like a Chicago Fire, do it, because those are big sets and you're going to learn a lot, you know?
Yeah. KR, do you have any specific advice to throw out to people with your experience in cinematography?
You know, it's as much as I talked about, you know, new gear and new things coming out, go out and shoot. That's really all you have to do. And that's how you learn. And it doesn't matter if you have $80,000 camera or a $200, you know, or your iPhone.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we've seen films in the past that have been shot entirely on iPhones.
Tangerine.
You know, not too long ago. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So go out and shoot and create content, because that's how you're going to learn.
Yep.
And Connor, I think you have a little bit of a philosophical thing to throw.
That might be a little overstating it, but I have no real experience in the film world beyond being a fan. Horror has always seemed to me to be an underappreciated piece of the art form. Sort of what you guys were talking about before, if you say, oh, I like a certain film, they sort of laugh at it, or they're watching certain aspects of your films, and some people have laughed at that. It doesn't... a lot of people are willing to throw that under the bus, but for me, horror has always been such a... It seems to rely on just the basic extremes of the human experience, on just like fear. There are aspects of great horror films which are actually hilarious, right? The Evil Dead, I think you can't go through that without cracking up a few times. Or I think, Nate, you said your favorite film was The Shining. There are scenes in that movie, just profound sense of boredom and or just mundanity.
Yeah.
And what I'm most interested in, I've always been very affected by horror films, especially as a young kid. And I'm sure we'll talk about this more in our following segment. But what I really wanted to know from you guys when I learned that you were going to be coming in today was, how do you, in your films, inject that that sentiment of the extremeness, or the, not extremism, but the... just that profound aspect of the human experience. I don't know. I'm rambling.
Like trying
bit.
To get that sense of like, because you're trying to describe something that's really kind of indescribable. How do you so that those parts of the human experience that come through in horror that go beyond the jump scares, go beyond the gore? How do you get those into the film?
Well, I think some of it comes from our own life experiences, and I think Nate can talk a little bit better about that for In Hiding in terms of, but it's more like putting our characters into these situations that, in reality never really happen, most likely, but, it all stems from what we have going on in our own lives. So, and I think Nate can, if he wants to, can talk about that, because In Hiding was essentially
personal.
Very, very personal.
Yeah. Please share.
Sure. So one of my favorite quotes about horror comes from my man, Stephen King. Yeah. And he said that horror has the capacity for allegory and metaphor that few other genres can match. And I think that's true. Horror allows you to tell stories that connect to wide audiences, but they can be very personal in terms of the connection, you know. So with In Hiding, the story is essentially a big sister having to take care of her little sister who just got shot and is bleeding to death, you know, and they can't leave this warehouse. So it's like right out of Reservoir Dogs territory. But for me, what that's speaking to is in 2014, I lost my twin brother to cancer. And so that movie for me is a metaphor on fear and guilt. And that demon just really represents this catalyst of like, you know, you're responsible for taking care of someone who's going to die. And like, how do you deal with that, you know? So for me, like, horror allows you to tell incredibly personal stories, but in a way that may be a little more subtle than that. Like someone watching that movie wouldn't guess that it's about me dealing with the loss of, you know, my brother, but that's really what it's about.
Thank you very much. That is fantastic, and it really gets to the core of the horror, you know, dealing with things that affect us. And the quote is true. It really does have a propensity for metaphor and allegory that few other genres have. Fantastic. Thank you again so much for joining us. If it's cool with you, would you like to join us for our after credit sequence? Because we are going to be talking a little bit about, you know, you guys are big horror guys. I want to talk really about this new trend in cinema, especially, I guess, a new wave in horror, or at least a new way of thinking about horror that's really brought it back to prominence. And I think that you two are going to be the ones to talk about it if you'd like to stick around.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds good.
All right. Awesome. You are listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGM Plus. I'm your host, Tom Hosch, joined by my co-host, Connor Cornelius, Nate Waters, and K.R. Brooks from Into the Void Films. We'll be right back in just a minute. Welcome back, everybody. This is No Coast Cinema, WGN Plus's premier film podcast, giving you the best guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I'm your host, Tom Hosch, joined, as always, by Connor Cornelius, my other host, and our guests today, Nate Waters and K.R. Brooks from Into the Void Films, Hello. Purveyors of horror. And magnitude and magnitude. Things like that.
What he said.
Yes. So right now we're going to be getting into our after credit sequence. We're going to wind down the show here by talking about a little trend here in horror cinema. We figured since we have these guys from Into the Void Films here to talk, we want to talk about the genre a little bit deeper, especially what's been going on the last few years. Now, Connor, I know you're a fan of horror, and I think we are both big fans of a lot of the horror that's been coming out recently.
Yeah, and I think the first film that I saw of the, you know, of the kind of mindset that you're speaking of, this new sort of approach to horror that I can think of, was It Follows.
Right.
2014. Because up until then, I feel like what I had been seeing were reboots of old slasher franchises. You know, Friday the 13th had come out not too long before that. Nightmare on Elm Street, yep. Which is one of the most horrifying movies to me of all time. Oh, the original,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah,
the new one, horrifying.
It's horrifying
in its own
in a different way. Yeah.
the Evil Dead reboot. So you see a lot of that, and you do, and that is sort of the continuing trend of what people seem to think of horror.
Right, and I think this new wave, how, you know, one of the things of characterizing a movement, and, you know, it's really, it's always subjective. Looking at movements in this way is always going to be subjective. But what I want to try to do is characterize what we see in these films and try to explain why it's proven to be such a comeback for the genre. I mean, we're seeing a renewed interest in making horror films of real stature here, and I guess we'll throw it to the Into the Void guys. Were you guys fans of It Follows?
Yes, to a certain degree.
To a certain degree?
Yeah. I'm not a fan of the last half hour of the movie, but I think the first hour is fantastic, and the score is awesome.
Yeah.
Disaster piece.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like, regardless of if you like the movie or not, the score is awesome.
Yes. Mm. Care.
I just felt like the whole concept of the movie was hilarious to me.
It is, right?
I mean, really, it's that,
it's that, like, it high just, school Halloween kind
of. Yeah, yeah, it does get into this realm of absurdity. I mean, all horror is kind of operating, and feel free to correct me if I'm way out of line here, but it's always operating in this level of absurdity because it is this heightened world that you're creating.
The trick is making characters that are believable enough to make the absurdity stick. You know?
Yeah. I would say this new set of movies, I'm going to try to throw out some names that I feel like fall into it. You know, It Follows was definitely one of them. I would say Get Out, definitely another big horror movie.
So to me, a big part of this movement stems from, like, we got to give credit where credit's due, Jason Blum from Blumhouse.
Oh, no doubt.
He is the guy who, you know, they are this production company where their idea is to take smaller movies that are shot for, like, you know, $4 million. I think if they're doing a sequel, they maybe do it for $10 million. But they put them in huge, you know, like, mainstream distribution. They put them on, like, 3,000 screens, and those movies make a lot of money. So to me, like, that's really what this new trend kind of hinges on, is they're low budget movies, but they're high concept ideas.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, and Blumhouse being directly responsible for things like The Conjuring,
The Purge. No, I'm sorry, Warner Brothers did The Conjuring.
Sorry.
Blumhouse did Insidious, right? Am I wrong on that?
But I feel like he's been Blumhouse Productions has been doing
Paranormal
everything.
Activity.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, right. they've been there since, like, Ouija. 09 doing that kind of stuff. Yeah.
They were involved in M. Night Shyamalan's Split.
Yep, which is a huge hit, and it was made for $10 million. So,
which is incredible. So looking at that, you mentioned low budget but high concept, which seems to be true. Mm-hmm. With Get Out, low budget. Relatively high concept. It's not, you know, there's not going to be much CGI, but it requires a little bit higher thinking.
It's ambitious in its own way.
There's fantastical things, like with the sunken place, and, like, there's all kinds of weird imagery in that movie. So, like, it is a bit of a higher concept, and it's also a little bit, it's an idea that kind of shakes people up a little bit.
Yeah.
So for a studio to, I mean, not even just a little bit, just a lot, you know,
right.
But for a studio, because, like, Jordan Peele's talked about how so many people rejected that script at first, and then, you know, like, it's the perfect socio-political climate for a movie like that to come out with everything that's going on in the world today.
Yes. And I think that's something that new horror movies are kind of trying to get at, is getting back to that idea of tackling social political problems, because you can see that in a lot of classic horror films. They're dealing with, you know, things bigger than the concept itself. With It Follows, it's dealing with teen sexuality and nostalgia, because it takes place in this, like, anachronistic world where it's like, one of the scenes from that, if you guys remember, when she opens, like, it looks like a makeup mirror.
Right.
It's like a shell. Yeah. And it's right. It's like a Kindle.
Right.
And you're just like, what the hell is this?
When is this movie happening?
Yeah. Yep.
And why doesn't someone get their iPhone out and just do something?
You know. Totally harkens back to that, like, 80s Halloween-esque.
Oh, yeah. It's a total Carpenter-esque, you know.
Even the music in that sounds like there's certain cues from Nightmare on Elm Street. With, like,
And if we'll stray into TV a little bit here, but Stranger Things.
Oh, yeah.
I guess you could call it, because it's so Stephen Kingy, you know. It's,
yeah,
similar scores too.
John Carpenter, all over. Yeah, Stranger Things was something that I was kind of late to the party on that.
Yeah.
Like Kevin had been telling me for months, like, dude, watch Stranger Things.
I don't know why it took him so long.
I'm lazy. Yeah,
really?
And then, once I finally got into it, like,
you're like, yes.
It's amazing. It's an amazing show, and it's like it felt like they had like zipped open my brain and pulled out things that I liked and then put it in this show.
Yeah.
Like, it felt like it was for me.
And that's another. I feel like that also deals with some social ills. Things like that. Split deals with mental illness. I don't even know if I would call that a horror, but on some level, it it has those horror ideas. It's a surprisingly horrifying movie. Especially the bit when the girl's getting like she goes in the closet and she's like getting her stomach eaten.
Yeah,
you can hear
so
it.
But I think horror. You know, like we're going back to having that capacity for metaphor and allegory. Horror has always had a place as far as making comments on the times. And you go back, you look at like the atomic movies from the 50s. All those monster movies are about the fear of radiation. And like, you know, Last House on the Left speaks on the fears of the Vietnam War. And that movie shot like a documentary because all this awful footage was coming back.
Right.
And so that's why they never cut. And then, you know, you get into like They Live territory where it's like the fear of Reaganomics and consumerism.
Yeah.
And,
so where is it? Where are we going next? Are we going to? I know Jordan Peele kind of wants to continue what he's doing with making these, taking on social horrors.
Yeah.
Do you think that's what we're most afraid of right now?
Well, I think Jordan Peele, what he's doing is, I mean, like horror has always taken on social fears. It's always done
right.
that. But what he's doing is he's acknowledging a big part of the horror audience that the mainstream studios don't acknowledge, which is the black audience.
Yes.
And he's talked about that. He's like, the black community, by and large, loves going to horror movies. They're a big part of that audience. So he wanted to make a movie for those people. And that's why that movie, you know, you watch it in a full house and it brings the house down.
Yeah.
You know, it's specifically designed to elicit a great audience response. But I mean, yeah, I think his movie is just really on the head with the social commentary. And it's, like I said, it's hitting at a perfect time. And people are really receptive to the message because they're like, finally, someone's saying what a lot of people have been thinking.
Yeah, is let's make horror movies for the people who are watching them and acknowledging stories that are traditionally untold.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah.
KR, is there anything that you're looking forward to in the horror genre? Are you seeing a comeback, or is this just the same? Like, are we just dressing it differently and giving it an 80s sheen? Because a lot of this stuff, like, we mentioned Stranger Things and It Follows, that was like total 80s throwback. So, are we just mining what we already have, or are we trying to forge something new here?
I feel like it's a little bit of both, honestly. It's like, you know, clothing. It goes through cycles. You know, you'll have a resurgence of something. I think that I guess right now we're in the 80s coming back into, you know, into the mainstream.
Get your perms, everybody.
Yeah. No, it reminds me of this time I was at like a clothing store with my mom when I was a teenager, and there was like this shirt that was from the 70s, and she's like, I wore that when I was a kid. Now it's coming back, you know?
And it's $100.
Yeah, no, exactly. Horror goes through these waves and cycles. It's kind of like a phoenix like that, where, you know, certain things will work, and then it'll go 15 years, and then it comes right on back, and then something about it speaks to people, you know?
Yeah. But we're getting this, like, horror seems to be a traditionally low-budget affair, even with the biggest of its films. So do you think that it's going to continue to be that? Like, does horror doesn't really change, does it, too much? It takes on different things. But it seems like, as a genre, they really steeped in tradition. You know, you got to pay homage to the forefathers. Is that – am I totally misreading that?
I don't feel like today's system is too far removed from, you know, like what Roger Corman would have done, where he makes these ultra-low-budget movies and then schleps them to all these different theaters himself, you know? And I think that the way that distribution and the video market has essentially dissolved, people aren't really buying DVDs and Blu-rays. A lot of people are, you know, either streaming or torrenting movies. So a big way that movies have to get out there is through streaming, and people aren't making as much money off movies, so the budgets go down.
Right.
So like for Hollywood, a low budget would have been like $10 million, right? So for us, like, you know, we're trying to make a movie for like $25,000, an obscenely low amount of money, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of considered the ultra low budget is like $100,000 and below.
Wow.
That's changed
like,
a lot.
Yeah. How do you even operate?
How do you do it? Yeah. And we know somebody, Julian Grant. He's a great, he's the king of indie cinema. That's what he's known as in Chicago for doing DIY stuff. He makes movies for like $3,000 and he gets distribution for them.
Wow.
You know?
So it's, with, is that your dream? Do you guys want to be the Indie Kings soon? At least the Indie Kings of Horror?
I want to have our own legacy. That is, people know us for our body of work. And also, right. You know, like, we love horror movies, but I wouldn't mind doing, like, an Amblin-style kids movie at some point.
Cool.
Doing something weird, you know, that's outside of horror. But, I mean, I don't want to be known just for that, but if we're known at all, I feel lucky. So
exactly.
I'm not going to complain. It's a champagne problem.
I hear you. Right. I hear you.
It's all about finding ways to cut those costs down. You know, like, we own, between Nate and I, everything we would need to make a film, you know, with maybe renting a couple things here and there. But, you know, that's just how we operate. And we figure out, you know, we kind of, like, going back to, like, the high concept sort of, at least for, you know, horror, like, we'll think of something that's crazy that we want to try and do, and we'll find out a dirt cheap way to do it that's effective on screen. And I think a good, a little tidbit for any horror filmmakers who are listening, if you need a cool blood splatter, just buy yourself an old empty fire extinguisher. And you can compress air in it and put blood, and you can shoot it all over the place. Yep. And it's yeah. about $20.
Yeah, we learned that from KMBFX, who worked on everything, you know, from, like, Dust Till Dawn to Kill Bill. And I saw that on Kill Bill on the behind the scenes. So yeah, like, I stole
well,
that shit.
It. Yeah.
It's awesome. Yeah, you get, like, those Evil Dead geysers of blood.
So. And is that not, like, a common trope in horror? Not, maybe not trope, but a filmmaking method is where it's historically a lower budget affair with horror movies, right? But you see innovation be birthed out of that. Yeah. You see the director of Evil Dead creating the turning the camera into an actual character, yeah. into not only the mm-hmm. a character, but the mm-hmm. antagonist of the film.
Which is iconic now. I mean, yeah. And they did it because they had no other choice. But, like, you know, at the time, they're like, shit, let's just put the camera on a board and have someone go, oh. And it sells it.
And it totally,
you know?
Works.
Yeah, it's the same thing with the shark in Jaws. If that shark would have worked, you would have seen it all over the movie. But because that shark, the first time they tested it out, it just sank.
Yeah.
They're like, well, we better just shoot POVs and input Dern and Dern yeah. under it. So.
And that's something that will stick with you, too. When I'm watching a horror movie now and I see a camera that's slightly moving, I'm thinking, is this the perspective of somebody that we're about to meet? Mm-hmm. Is this some supernatural, you know?
Mm-hmm. It totally changes the paradigm.
It yeah. does.
It does. All right. Into the Void Films on the new wave of horror. So basically, the
Do we have a name for this? Is there a name for this new sort of movement within horror where it's actually like...
I'm not sure there is yet, because I remember the one before this, it was the found footage trend.
Right.
Right.
And then before
right.
that was either, you want to call it torture porn or Gorno.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which
was
like
yeah.
the Saw Hostel thing, you know.
And you had like new horror, which was...
The remake craze was before that.
Yeah, that was like 13 Ghosts and yep. Jason X, right. yeah, which yeah, is a fantastic
oh,
film.
Oh, man. Shout out to Todd Brown. He's the director of that.
Holy
the
cow.
Writer. He's awesome. But before that was like the Scream era, so it was like
yeah,
everything.
It was like postmodern,
meta stuff.
So I guess we'll just have to wait and see. I think we're seeing a lot of good horror come out, even, you know, in the next few years. We'll see how it goes, and we'll coin the term.
We're gonna get there.
I will personally call these guys from Into the Void and be like, I need something. Good God, please.
Let us know when
this.
You figure it out. Yeah,
oh, yeah.
I don't know what to call it yet, yeah. besides, you know, low budget, high concept.
Because
that's too long.
Nothing says creative integrity like four white guys in a room.
That's
All right. So before we get out of here, something I always like to do is check in with everybody, see what we've been watching recently, what we're excited to watch. And this can include pretty much anything, you know. Oh, wow, lost it there for a second.
That sounds good, Tom. Don't worry about
just
it.
Just get it there. Just, you know, yeah. So this can be films or television. You know, television is still an important thing. It's taken on a more cinematic role. So, Connor, what have you been watching recently? Have you been or excited about watching?
Well, I did watch a little-known horror gem, Moana. A couple days ago.
Yes.
I did watch that, but I actually had a double feature with a couple of my roommates the other night, and we watched Moana, and right before that we watched Demon, which is a Polish horror film. I can't remember the director, but my roommate that decided to put it on told me that the director actually committed suicide following the release of the film, which you know, real life stories that are tied to film, sort of that kind of gives it a little bit more of a tragic bend. It may kind of changes the experience when you're watching it.
So what is the plot of Demon? Like, what
So it's it's incredible. It does a great job of combining the aspects of horror that you kind of want to see. It's there's, you know, obviously the scare aspect of it, but there is sort of kind of a comedy aspect at the very end. The plot of the film is a man is, it's a Polish wedding, and they're holding it on this plot of land, this like muddy farm area in this barn, and at some point the groom gets possessed by a female ghost because her corpse is dug up outside of the wedding venue. And it is basically just, the comedy comes from the dad trying to keep it under wraps that the groom is possessed. And he's just, he's like, no, we paid for it. We've got to get these people, just keep feeding them booze. We'll make it a 3-day just drunken blackout affair. And he's just, so he's, it's him and all of the other people that are involved in trying to, at the same time, manage the possessed main character and understand why the things are happening, but also there's this kind of hilarious subplot of trying to make sure that all of the guests at the party are like still drunk.
Wow.
And then at the very end, this guy, the Polish dad, walks up to the stage and he just addresses the whole crowd and he's like, this wedding never happened. He's just trying to like convince people that just never happened. It was hilarious. I thought it was pretty good.
I'm gonna have to seek that one out. Yeah.
Demon.
Polish. All right, KR, been watching anything recently? Are you looking forward to anything?
So the last film that I saw was The Void.
Ah, yes.
So not to be confused, not with our Void, but The Void, which I saw at the Music Box Theater, actually with Nate.
Oh, yeah. If you guys want to jump in on that, do a double.
Yeah. The thing about that movie was the practical effects. They actually had fountains of blood and actual creatures that were, they're not CGI, you know. There was, I think there was maybe one little thing.
The triangle portal thing.
Yeah, so there was like a little bit of CGI, but they did it all on set, actually, which I thought was super impressive.
Wow.
Because not only is it very expensive to do things that way,
yeah,
but it's also great because it's like a throwback to everything else and how it used to be done.
Yeah. What's the plot of The Void? Like, what, give us a general overview.
Essentially, go ahead.
So a sheriff is on patrol in a sleepy small town, and nothing's happening. And this bloody, beat up dude comes out of the woods and needs help, and he like passes out. So the sheriff takes the guy to the hospital, and the hospital is being operated by a skeleton crew because there's a fire there recently. So there's not a lot of people there, and so it's basically like five people holed up in this hospital, and all of these guys in white cult robes appear outside the hospital with knives, and everybody can't leave. They're stuck in there, and it's like combining The Thing with Assault on Precinct 13.
Mm-hmm. Oh wow!
And then so the cult, you find out that there's some culty shit in the culty stuff in the basement. It's very Lovecraftian, and there's a lot of tentacles and spider legs and weird sundry legged things.
Oh,
and
Christ,
it's fun. It's a lot of fun. And it's like, we're talking about, it seems to be that like the 80s is making a comeback as far, mm-hmm, as horror. And it's totally, it's like the guys that made that movie are from the production company Astron 6, which they did like The Editor, and I'm forgetting, sorry guys, some of your other movies, but they're great guys, and they do things that are kind of rooted in the 80s and late 70s.
I like that. So that's showing at the Music Box. I know that. Yep. They had a pretty, based on what I saw, because I was trying to see it really bad at the Music Box, one of my favorite theaters here in the city, apart from the new 400 in Rogers Park. But I know that they like sold out that first weekend. People were jazzed about it. Now they're showing it at like 9:30 pretty much every night. So definitely get out there. Would you give it a heavy recommendation, or you know, thumbs up? Definitely check it out at least.
I would say check it out.
Yeah, check it out. If you're a fan of that kind of stuff, you'll like it.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you both at least enjoyed it?
Oh yeah,
I enjoyed it for sure. There, you know, it like a lot of films, it had its moments where you're just like, Come on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I enjoyed it. Overall, I liked it.
Because it's a mashup of like five different genres. So sometimes it's like, well, that's a little out of place. But I mean, like for what they did on the budget they did, it's pretty cool to see, you know?
That's excellent. All right. Definitely. And it is, if you're not able to make it out to the music box or you're not living somewhere where you have a small theater that's showing it, it is available video on demand. I know that's, odds are that's how I'm going to end up watching it, even though it's not ideal for me. Like, that might be how it is. As long as I see it, that's what I care about, really. All right.
Tom, what have you been watching lately?
Oh, wow. I'm trying to watch The Void, but I actually saw the big Japanese hit movie, Your Name. I was in Austin last weekend, and I made it out to a Alamo Draft House, which was an interesting experience. If you've never been to it or if you've never heard of it, it's basically a theater where you get tableside service. Like, you sit in your seat, and in front of you there's a big, long, like, table, and there's like almost like a service well row right in front of that behind the next row of seats. And you literally like place orders for beer and food and all that kind of stuff before the show comes, you know, before the show comes on. And it's pretty great. It was a different experience. I don't know if I would do it that often. If they had one in Chicago, I'd maybe go there every once in a while if I wanted to get the full deal there, but I'm definitely more of a traditionalist when it comes to seeing. But like, I would go to the music box, sit with my, you know, popcorn, and they serve beer at the music box if you want a beer. Mm-hmm. But you know, none of that. You got to be into the experience. Yeah. But
how many showrooms do they have at the Draft House?
At the Draft House I was at, they've got multiple. It's like franchised. Like, they have it all around the U.S. But they started in Texas. I think they had like nine. Something to that effect.
I was going to say, I'm a little surprised that Your Name got such a high-profile screening event.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's because of how successful it was in Japan. Number one film of 2016 for them. Wow. It's been getting rave reviews. And, you know, Alamo Drafthouse is like the music box in terms of the curation. So they're showing those indie films that you're probably not going to catch at like your local AMC, unless it's a really big AMC. You've got an AMC that, like, downtown here in Illinois, 21 screens, you know, they're probably going to have at least a showing of it. But they were showing it at the one I was at, and it was really good. It's pretty typical romantic anime fare, but like,
horrific in its own way, right?
Yeah.
There's the body switching.
The body switching. This is the main thing. It's basically Freaky Friday if Freaky Friday were a love story. It's about a girl who lives out in the sticks in Japan, like way outside Tokyo, and she just kind of dreams of being, you know, an upscale, you know, Tokyo boy and get all the advantages provided to her for that. And one day there's like this comet and it's passing by, and she wakes up and she is the boy. Her and a boy in Tokyo have switched bodies, and you know, hilarity ensues. Like, the boy is just like, I'm a girl, so he grabs her chest like a bunch. He's like, I can't believe it, this is what they feel like.
And there's the horror element.
Yeah. the horrible defiling of a teenage body. No, that's a little bit aggressive.
It's not horrible or defilement, probably. I haven't seen the movie.
It's for comedic effect, but it really is very cute. It's it's got a weird like time travel element to it that comes later on. I don't know if I want to spoil it, but that does happen, and the comet comes into play real heavy. So I think it was like a full 2 hours and 15 minutes for an animated film, so good for them.
Wow. Nice.
But yeah, I definitely recommend it. If you're into anime, you've probably already seen it, but definitely go see it if you want to check it out. Not my favorite animated film of all time, but definitely worth the experience. And I got a delicious burger out of it.
There you go.
So there you go. And in terms of things I'm looking forward to, I know we're not focused on Hollywood here, but The Last Jedi. Drop the trailer.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
We can't not talk about
I'm,
that.
I'm avoiding it, actually.
It's epic.
Really?
Yeah.
That's watched it?
That's my method. I avoid all trailers.
How, though? For the news, you didn't even want to see a little bit? It doesn't even reveal anything.
Well, the first things, so on my social, on my, you know, news feed on, or whatever, my feed on Facebook is, you have to click on it to go to it. So I'm okay now. Mm-hmm. But when they start doing just those videos that will just play at the top of your feed where you can't not, if I see Mark Hamill in the Jedi robes, if his face just appears out of a dark square, I don't know if I'll be able to have the, you know, the mental wherewithal to avoid it. But
for right now,
I'm trying to
also,
not.
Also, I got to point out how you said Mark Hamill's last
name. Yeah,
Hamill?
Hamill.
Mark Hamill.
Mark Hamill.
Hamill.
I like Mark Hamill. I think it has a certain...
Yeah. No, it's Hamill.
Hamill? What did you say? Forget
it. He said Hamill.
Whatever.
Listen, it's Mark Hamill. Let's move on. Hamill.
The film also stars Carrie Fisher.
Fisker?
Yeah. Kylo Ren.
Kylo Ren. Daisy Ridley. Thanks for that episode of Great Bits.
You're welcome.
Good bits. All right, guys. So that is the end of Hot Takes. That is the end of NoCo Cinema for this edition. I want to thank again Nate Waters and also KR Brooks from Into the Void Films. Where can they find you on Facebook, YouTube? Where's your presence?
On Facebook, it's just Into the Void Films. We have a YouTube channel, Into the Void Films, as well.
And we also have a website, intothevoidfilms.net.
Yep.
And that's under construction right now, coming soon.
Yeah, coming
very
soon. Very soon.
All right, so hopefully we'll get that soon because we want to check out as much of your stuff as possible. Thank you both again so much for coming on the show. Best of luck to you for the films in the future. Hopefully we'll be seeing them soon.
Thank you.
Thank you again to Connor.
Thank you, Tom. Love you.
I love you, too, and I also hate you
so
much.
Yeah, it's getting there.
I can feel the love and the hate.
God.
It's swirling around.
Yeah. Next time, we're going to have a fight to the death.
Oh, man.
That'll be the main feature.
That'll be the next
no
episode.
No guess. It's just going to be just the audio of a you know, stick fight.
Just a broken pool cue. Yep. Two people trying to just
make it fast.
Two men enter, just one man leaves. Perfect. All right. And I have been your host, Tom Hush. Thanks for listening. This has been NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus, your guide to cinema here in Chicago and around the world. We will see you next time. Good morning, good evening, good night.